Studio 360 is supported by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats worldwide. More information at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson, your host. And I say that because for only the second time since we've been on the air, I'll be handing over the keys to Studio 360, and I'll be leaving everything in the hands of an incredibly talented, charismatic, versatile, intelligent guy.
Hello?
Is that Alan Cumming?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Mr. Cumming. This is Kurt Anderson.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm still curious about why you agreed to do this, frankly. I shouldn't look this gift horse in the mouth.
I don't know either, Kurt. It was a really foolish, precious moment, and I'm totally regretting it.
No, it'll be easy.
You know, it's rare that you go on a show as an interviewee and have actually a proper, intelligent, thought-provoking chat. That's the experience I had when I came on your show, and so when I was asked to do it when you're away, I really thought that would be fascinating for me to be at the other side of that and have a chat with some people that I find really fascinating.
Aw, shucks. Well, you will be fascinating. But, of course, you have to speak in a perfect American accent now.
Oh, gosh. Darn it. I can't.
There you go. Well, if I decide not to come back, you're good to just keep doing this indefinitely, right?
I've got it down, I think. You just get interesting people and you just ramble on. And they'll fix it in post.
Exactly. I'm so pleased you're going to be doing this. And have fun.
I will.
Thank you.
All right, Kurt. Bye.
Bye.
And here I am in Studio 360. I'm Alan Cumming. And I'm pretty busy at the moment because we're in the middle of filming the new season of The Good Wife. I'm in Cabaret on Broadway. And I also have my memoir, Not My Father's Son, coming out on October the 7th. But I still couldn't miss the chance to fill in for Kurt and take over Studio 360 for a week. When I was asked to do this, I immediately started a list of people I'd love to sit down and have a good chat with. One of them is a photographer called John Dugdale, who's blind, and I've admired his work for years. Another is someone I know very well, one of my dear friends, Cyndi Lauper. I remember dancing to Cyndi Lauper's music in the early 80s, when her debut album, She's So Unusual, came out. What I liked most of all was the amazing, wonderful, positive spirit that shone through. But I really fell in love with her when we did the Threepenny Opera together in 2006 on Broadway. She was Pirate Jenny, and I was Mac the Knife.
And in those days, so very long ago, things weren't as sad and grim as they are now. It's true, we men love only in the day.
So, she's had huge pop hits, she's starred on Broadway, but there's all these other facets to her. She's won a Grammy for a blues album. She's done electronic dance music. And last year, she won a Tony Award for writing the Broadway musical Kinky Boots. She's also a champion for LGBT rights and one of the funniest women I know. Cyndi Lauper, welcome to Studio 360.
You know, Alan.
What?
Alan Cumming.
What?
You always called me Cyndi Lauper no matter what.
I know.
You never call me Cyndi.
No, I always call you Cyndi Lauper.
I know.
Wonder why that is.
I don't know, but it's funny.
I like it, Cyndi Lauper. I want to start by playing my absolute favorite song of yours.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's called Above the Clouds. Let's hear
really?
It.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Stand tall and
wow.
I love that song so much. Are you tearing up?
Yeah, I remember when I was writing it, and I used to sing that when I would talk, you know, just before I started on this whole big True Colors thing and fund and the tours. I met Judy Shepherd.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew Shepherd's mom.
Yeah, and she was looking really kind of down, and I said, you know, first I said, you look like you could have a drink. Any vodka here? So, you know, vodka sort of referred. No, she just had a shot and we sat and laughed. And I said, you know, you look like you need to come on tour. Why don't you just come on tour with me and we'll get this message out. And so I used to sing this. I used to have her cards and Matthew Shepard Foundation on the seats. And then I'd take a second and talk and say, listen, you know, you can do the whole political thing, but politics won't really change us. What changes us is what goes on in our families. You know, and I said, you have to look at this realistically. We didn't just lose Matthew, but we lost the perpetrators too. Their lives are done. Mm. And if you preach hate to your children, you're going to ruin them.
Mm.
And so it starts in your home. You want to change things? Start at home. And then I'd sing this song about, you know, it's in a way, it's a little bit about bullying. Every kid you have, they get bullied once in a while, you know?
Yeah, everyone gets bullied. Or everyone understands what it's like to be an outsider.
Well, we certainly do. I do. You know, I relished in it after a while, but not everybody reacts the same. I enjoyed possibly scaring people. You know, I don't mind walking down the road and people are like, oh, I'm moving to the other side. That's fine. I like all the space. I want all the space. No, you know, I'm kidding.
And this song as well, I think it was interesting because it's the album's called The Body Acoustic, and it's kind of a greatest hits album. But what's interesting is that you decided to do, instead of just like rehashing, re-releasing and your old hits and maybe a couple of new ones like people normally do, you'd re-recorded your earlier songs acoustically with interesting people. And I think that's such a great thing about you, that you never rest on your laurels. You're always exploding. Even within your own oeuvre, you're rediscovering things. And that's such a great testament to you as an artist.
Oh, thank you. I like that whole oeuvre thing.
Oeuvre. It's French, you know. It's French.
Yeah, I like that French stuff. Very chic.
So why did you do that? Why did you go acoustic?
Well, I had been all the time since 94, 93. Because of Half Full of Stars, I did some acoustic things in there, and I mixed like folk with blues and hip hop. And that's when it led into one thing, which led into another, which led into me picking up my dulcimer again and just playing. And they were having stuff on MTV Unplugged, but they never let me play Unplugged. So it was kind of like Gracie Field. I don't know. I guess I wasn't.
Is it Gracie Fields?
Yeah. Well, you know, remember that song Gracie Fields sang, I took me harp to the party, but nobody asked me to play? It was kind of like that. So when they said, you're going to do a best of, I said, fine, let's do that unplug thing I was never allowed to
do. I get it. We'll find
it back. It's a long story. Wow. I finally got back. Wow. Went on a big journey, but here we are. Focus.
I love that. That's great. It's interesting you're talking about acoustic music because that's sort of how I know you most in terms of, or as long as we've known each other, seeing you in sort of smaller venues and singing with you on stage. But you have people might not realise, you have a 4-octave range.
Well, I don't know if I have a...
Oh, you don't anymore?
I don't know. All I know is I still take vocal lessons and I still work on my voice all the time.
What I'm saying is you have a very incredible instrument.
Thank you.
And it transcends what people might, if they know your some of your most successful songs, it transcends that perception, I think.
Well, even my very pop, the like Girls Just Want to Have Fun, try and sing it in F sharp. See how that goes for you.
Challenge Alan.
You have to have a lot of vocal strength to do that. I don't know. I just keep working on my voice. I want to be a great singer.
You are a great singer, Cyndi
Lauper. Some days. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, what kind of sound was that? But, you know.
When did you know that you wanted to be a singer?
When I was 2.
What happened?
We lived in Williamsburg. The lady upstairs, I was supposed to call her Senora, but, you know, I couldn't, so I called her Senuda. And unfortunately, that was never fixed. So at 12 years old, I was still calling her Senuda, which in Italian or Sicilian means you're nude. And she had a husband, Sitsi Paulie. That would be Uncle Paul for little kids.
Uh-huh.
Only my sister Ellen, she couldn't pronounce it, so she said Titsy Paulie. So we were calling these poor people Titsy Paulie and your nudes. And God bless them. But Senuda,
yeah,
she taught me how to sing right away. I'd hold on to her fingers, and I'd sing. It was some song like Bella, Bella, ba-da-da-da-da. And then I'd put on shows like she'd make me sing for people. That's when I kind of felt like I was that and dressing up. And people would say, oh, what do you want to be? And I would say, I want to be an actress, because I didn't realize what it was. I would watch TV and watch Judy Garland, and she was always singing and dancing. So I said, I want to do that. So she was an actress. So
right.
I'd say that. But they'd go, oh, really? Do you know what an actress does? And I'd say, well, you know. So I always look at kids when they say they want to do something, and I'm always intrigued, because a grown-up's perception of that is totally different.
Yeah.
But a kid's perception of that is a wide scope of things. So I always say, that's fantastic.
Yeah, me too, because it's about their spirit exploding, and they may not end up doing that, but at least they've got sort of something that's...
A lot of times they may.
And they may. And they may.
Laughed. They were laughing at me. And but you know, they thought I was, even in my career, you know, Harvey Fierstein said something once while we were doing an interview, and it at first knocked me off my chair. And he said, listen, they think she's stupid because of the way she talks. And I was like, really? They think I'm stupid? No. I knew that people always thought that, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because I made people laugh a lot and told funny stories, they equated that with stupidity.
And do you think that's, as a woman, that's compounded?
I don't know, as a woman, because I was always kind of a freak. So, you know, I have no idea, you know. I came out with boxing gloves, and
oh, yeah.
I was determined that I would live my life with the same civil liberties that men did. And that was at a very young age, so... I don't know.
But it must be, I mean, you are extraordinary in that you've had this long career, and, you know, you did start as a pop star, a young woman pop star, and as we know, they have a short shelf life. And you're remarkable in that you've not only lasted, but you've diversified and gone and done so many different incredible things.
Yeah, but, you know, somebody told me once, it was actually Dick Clark, and he was always very kind to me, but he did say that a woman's career in this business is 10 years. And I thought to myself, well, what do you think of that now? He said, never like, you know, the men, they have resurgence. And
mm-hmm.
I was thinking, why, you dirty rat, you know. I didn't
why
say
I
that
order.
To him. Why I order? That's what I was thinking, but I didn't say anything because, you know, it was Dick Clark. But he also said that pop music is disposable. That's when I said something. I said, it isn't disposable, because I took my whole life dedicated to singing and making music that would inspire people to help them get back up again. And that's not disposable.
No.
And it's funny, because some of those pop songs that everybody was singing way back when, people still listen to them.
Yeah.
And it means something to them, you know. I don't think that music is disposable.
Certain songs just were going to last forever. I mean, I talking.
They mark the time.
Yes, they absolutely do. Yeah, and your music certainly has done that over the 75 years of your career. Cyndi Lauper is my guest. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in a minute to talk more about her amazing career. I'm Alan Cumming, sitting in today for Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Just a little bit longer. Please, 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 please tell me that you're going to stay.
Studio 360 is supported by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lookout, working to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Alan Cumming, sitting in today for Kurt Anderson, because apparently they let him take vacation or something. Cyndi Lauper has some of the biggest pop songs ever. She's an incredible champion of LGBT rights. She's done Broadway, electronica, blues, and she is a person of real integrity. Cyndi Lauper, I want to play you one of my favourite songs of yours, Shine, from the early 2000s.
This is off the album, right?
Yeah.
It's the best version for me. I like this version. I think it's right. And it's inspiring, you know?
You know what it says about you're going to be great. Everything, you're good enough. And I think that's a lovely message to send to people.
Well, yeah, and that these embers
they're going to
burst
ignite
into flames.
Yeah. It's gorgeous.
I mean, I had to live my whole... I mean, my career never went like my peers. I just kept trying and I wouldn't take no.
I wanted to talk to you about that, actually, about peers, because, you know, like, in every generation there's a sort of a rivalry, like Christina, Britney.
But they're not real.
I know they're not, but they're in the zeitgeist. That's what,
of course.
You know, Katy Perry and Lady Gaga.
The record companies, it's not them.
But it exists in the world.
Oh, yeah, I know. There were some people on the Cyndi Lauper side and the others on the Madonna side.
So what does that feel like? You're sort of in this partisan place.
Well... When it first happened, it threw me for a loop.
I bet.
Because I, first of all, liked her. And second of all, it's another woman.
Yeah.
Sisterhood is a powerful thing and you can't break that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was broken to me all of a sudden. And everyone was saying, you're better than her. I said, I'm different than her.
Mm-hmm.
She's different from me. You know, but it became this pissing war between... the two record companies, and I was like, oh, well. I never really felt like I was good enough anyway. I really didn't. I always tried harder because I didn't think, you know, it would be good enough.
Why?
Why?
Yeah, I mean, just can you try and explain what things that you didn't feel you were good enough at?
Well, I always kind of felt like the little engine that could. You know, like we could do a video, but it would be for a quarter of the amount that all the big guys were doing it. And that made sense. Okay. But then all of a sudden, I was thrown into the big guy arena, expected to compete with people who had so much behind them. And I was always like the little engine that could. And then, you know, we did do the wrestling thing, and that was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Tell me again about the wrestling thing. Because I wasn't here in this country then. So you were a big pop star.
No, I wasn't.
Oh.
I had done the album. I had met Lou Albano on an airplane.
He's a wrestler.
Captain Lou. He was just a crazy, funny. And I used to watch him on TV, and he would have the wild Samoans behind him, two very large guys with wildish hair. And they would just be behind him, moving like apes almost, nodding their heads as Captain Lou went on and ranted how he's going to take him to number one, to minus 10, back to number one, to, you know. And it just made me laugh, and I thought, oh, my God, he's so crazy.
And Sergeant Slaughter, Captain Lou Albano.
Come out here. Let's talk about the return match. We're thoroughly prepared. We're ready. I'm ready. They're ready. He's ready. He's ready. Are you ready? Are you ready?
I don't know.
You're ready. But I'm ready, Teddy.
And we were looking for a guy to play my father in Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and Ed Griles, who was the director, said, let's use Gorgeous George, which is probably a good choice.
Who's Gorgeous George?
He's another wrestler.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I said, listen, I met Captain Lou Albano on the plane, and he was so funny. Let's use him.
Right.
Then we started thinking, and remember those old beach movies where they had the kahuna? And the big kahuna was a little cuckoo in the beach movies?
Yeah, like a beach party Babylon or
That's
something.
That's it, yeah. So I thought, why not have Lou be my big kahuna? And I'll just listen to everything he says because he's the big kahuna.
I see.
And we started doing interviews like that, and it was so funny. All of a sudden, all the promotion you'd normally do, which you want to rip your hair out because, you know.
Boring.
I'm sorry. Let me talk about myself a little more.
And answer that question for the 7,000th time.
Yeah, but Lou made everything hysterical.
So he came on press tours with you as a kind of like, you're like a double act.
Well, kind of. Yeah. And I would kind of act dopey like the Samoans. He would say something and I'd nod.
Yeah.
And he's the maker of champions, and he said, you know, Sin, you too can be a champion.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw the rubber band in his beard and the earrings, see, I like earrings.
Yeah, he.
And I tell you, I just knew I had to talk to this girl.
Now, what other...
And so this is just the time when your first album was coming out.
Yeah, it was coming out, and when Girls Just Want to Have Fun came out, it only got like 3 ads in 1 week, and the record company was looking at us going... It's not doing so good. Should we just go with the ballad? And I didn't want to go with the ballad because all my friends who had gone with ballads first, when they came with the up-tempo song, it didn't stick. So I said, if you could win with an up-tempo song, then you can come with anything you want.
Right.
So nobody would add our record. So Dave Wolf, my manager at the time, said, I have an idea. Wrestling had Friday night, Saturday morning and Saturday night on TV. So you had three hits.
See.
And this was his idea that we do rock and wrestling connection. And then it kind of grew from there because Andy Kaufman and Deborah Harry, they kind of started something, but we kind of took it.
So the wrestling thing
different.
Was kind of like from the very beginning, you were kind of involved and that was a sort of a...
Well, that broke my record.
I didn't realize that. See, I thought that was something you did later.
No, it broke my record. Now, in England, I just went over there and everybody accepted me. But I think that's because I was speaking the Queen's English. So they just related.
Wake up, Cinderlupper. Wake up. I wanted to talk a bit about... You're in your 60s now, Cyndi Lauper. I don't know if you've realised that.
Yeah.
And you just won a Tony.
Hey, just.
What?
Just.
What?
61.
I mean, you just won a
65.
Tony.
65.
I'm just saying, you're in your early 60s. Your very early 60s.
All right.
And you just won a Tony for writing the score for a musical. You must admit, even in your self-deprecating way, you've had this incredibly fertile, eclectic...
No, I've had a really wild... and wonderful career, and I'm still going. And every time I hit a door that closed, I looked for another one.
But why do you think is it purely because of sort of obstructions and being told no that you've had this incredibly eclectic thing?
Yeah.
Is it something about your...
No.
Is it really just that?
Yeah.
Just that people have said no to you and so you've done something else?
How many times are you going to take no? Well, every time you think I'm going to be here and you're stopping me with your gatekeepers, I'm going to show up someplace else and someplace else and say, oh, look, now I'm here. So think you could stop me now? You know, but that's not a good way to think, I know, because presenting a challenge brings a challenge. I got that. But I love music and I love writing it and I love singing it. So why are you going to be told what you can and cannot do by people who can't?
We're going to hear a clip from Kinky Boots now, your top international Broadway musical.
Which one are you going to play?
We're going to play one because, you know, I've got a book coming out that I wrote a memoir and it's called, guess what? Not My Father's Son. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, you know, can I tell you something about it?
Yes.
I was, because of my experience with David and Declan, my son and my husband, and watching Declan grow up and David being so patient. Like my mother-in-law said to him one time, you have the patience of Job, and he does. And I've seen Declan walk out in his little armor with all the other kids with their little, you know, hockey gear, which makes them look like gladiators or little Spartans, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where the line came from, with the strength of Sparta and the patience of Job.
Ah.
Still couldn't be the one to echo what you've done and mirror what was not in me, so...
Let's hear it. This is Billy Porter.
Look at me, powerless and holding my breath, trying hard to repress what scared him to death. It was never easy to be his type of man. To breathe freely was not in his plan. And the best part of me is what he would see. I'm not my father's son. I'm not the image of what he dreamed of. With the strength of Sparta and the patience of Job,
there it is.
Still couldn't be the one.
I got to see my son walk like my husband and then not want to walk like him, and then feel like he couldn't be what my husband, what he thought my husband expected, you know. So it's a, he doesn't, we just want him to be happy. And, you know, kids, they go through a lot and then they hopefully come out okay. It is what it is. And he's a great, great guy, you know. What are you going to do? Now join a rock band. Come on. No.
Be normal. Become a rock star. Cyndi Lauper, how do you look so good? How do you, what is your secret? I mean, I know some of your secrets, but just in terms of, you're a 61-year-old woman, you look fantastic, you have the energy of a 20-year-old. What do you think is your...
I don't know.
...life force?
I don't know.
But there's something, don't you think, like, you're a very alive person.
I guess, in a lot of ways, I like to be alive. I think it's a good thing. I like, I enjoy really, really simple things too about life. I like to sit still and wait for the life around you. Like if you were sitting in the woods, cause mosquitoes I don't quite enjoy, but you know, watching little, dragonflies. You know, I think they're really fantastic, or listening to the birds or watching them gather. This is a big moment. Because it's the fall, and they're going to gather, and then they're going to fly south. You know, they used to gather in the woods behind my house in Connecticut. They don't do that anymore. Somebody shot off a gun, and they never came back. And that was a big heartbreak, because I used to sit and giggle, because some of them were so loud and noisy and just silly, and I thought that was the funniest thing. You know, because I just imagine them, you know, what they might be saying to each other, you know, like, oh, I don't know. Did you pack? I did. I don't know. I'm going light, you know. It's Florida, baby. Just bring your sunscreen.
Pair of flip-flops. Well, Cyndi Lauper, good luck with you and whatever you do.
And
I know
too.
It'll be fantastic and inventive and hilarious. And it's been so lovely chatting
Thank
to you.
Thank you.
Cyndi Lauper, ladies and gentlemen, Cyndi Lauper is leaving the building.
Thank you, Alan Cumming.
Okay, stop now. You've got to go. We're getting into trouble.
Okay.
The Broadway musical Kinky Boots just started its national tour. It's in Tempe, Arizona this week, heading all over the country through 2015. In a moment, one of the most inspiring artists I've ever come across, a photographer who just happens to be blind.
Being blind is not what you think. It's not all darkness. My optic nerve still works and shoots a beautiful ball of brightly colored orange and purple violet light and sparkling flashes all the time.
Photographer John Dugdale is my guest in a moment. I'm Alan Cumming. In today for Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay
Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Alan Cumming. Kurt Anderson is taking a break for a couple of weeks. He's in an undisclosed location, a.k.a. rehab. And next week, the brilliant critic Hilton Earls will be your guest host. Hilton will talk to one of the greatest living authors, Toni Morrison, in her living room. But that's next week. I'm not ready to hand over the mic just yet. For a long time, I've been wanting to reconnect with the photographer John Dugdale. He makes gorgeous cyanotype photographs using a camera that dates back to the late 1800s. What is as incredible as the photographs is the fact that John is blind. In the 80s, he was infected with HIV, and in 1994, he suffered a stroke that left him paralysed for a year and nearly blind. Over the years, John lost his remaining vision, but he has never stopped taking photographs. I first met John after seeing his work in a gallery. We were introduced by a friend and John asked me to pose for him. But, and this might surprise you, listeners, I got shy. I was actually a bit in awe of him and I lost my nerve. So now, all these years later, I'm finally getting the chance to sit down with him. Mr. John Dugdale, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
When I met you, you were partially blind, and now you're completely blind.
Yes.
But yet all through that time, until now, you continue to take photographs and you're working on a new book right now. Just to explain to the listeners, how do you go about making a photograph?
I have a giant Deerdorf camera from about 1905, and I have a few wonderful people in my life that I trust explicitly to help me create the pictures, you know, that I see in my mind. And the view camera has an 11 by 14 glass in the back, a ground glass. And I stand underneath the cloth and describe geometrically where I want the subject to be. And they rough it up. And then I use my fingers and they trace the outline of the photograph. And I can correct it even a millimeter of in any direction just to make sure it's exactly what I see in my mind.
There was a spell when you would sit in the show the model how you wanted them to sit. Do you still do that?
Almost always. It's much easier, and it puts the subject at ease. It lets me know that they understand what I'm thinking. It becomes a co-creation with someone.
And in the final part, you take the picture yourself.
I insist on making sure I release the shutter bulb at that very important 15th of a second.
Right.
That's the only speed that camera has. It's the most sacred time in my life whenever the shutter opens and closes in that moment. And it's pretty much also the only time I'm quiet.
maybe you should go back a wee bit. So you came to New York and you were like a fabulous young thing and you're jetting all over the world. And you're...
No, I was jetting all around the East Village and sometimes the West Village where I live now. But I came to New York. I went to the School of Visual Arts, graduated in 84. A little ways into that, when I was about 22, some friends were doing a book about flowers. I was much too snobby to think of doing color work at the time. But they said, oh, please come upstate, which is a great consequence to go upstate. It changed the course of my life. I experimented. I went up with no equipment in a snowstorm. I had no idea people even lived in such beauty. And I went with a clip-on lamp from Canal Street. I got there, though, this is kind of boring. I wanted them to look like Renaissance illuminations. Uh-huh. John Kelly, which is how I met these people, your friend and mine,
Kelly.
The lovely John Kelly.
Performance artist and
all-around darling man. And he had left a pair of pantyhose. And I thought, well, these pictures are so dull with this clip-on lamp. So I looked around and I unscrewed the yellow bug light from above the door. And I thought, it's still not quite right. And I rummaged around. And John had performed as Joni Mitchell and left a pair of pantyhose. I stretched those over the bulb. And then all the pictures came out with a rosy, orangish hue. And they looked like I said, the little illuminations from a Bible. And then the rest of the story, in a sense, is that the next 10 years, I did an enormous amount of commercial work for everyone that you can think of.
In that same style, in that kind of Renaissance?
More or less, depending on the subject.
And did you use pantyhose as a...
No, I graduated to an official softbox and a Pentax 6x7 camera. And it was, you know, everything from food pictures for the New York Times, to wedding dresses for Bergdorf Goodman.
Right. And so you had this big career based on this kind of really fascinating aesthetic that you'd created.
By accident.
By accident.
So I knew always if I would go outside the studio and lean against a building and look up at the sky that I wasn't doing what I had meant to do. But, you know, when people are offering you that enormous amount of money when you're 25, it's kind of hard to say no.
So you contracted HIV in what?
Oh, probably early on, 84, 85.
Oh, right. So tell us about that. You started to go blind as a complication of HIV. And what year was this, 93?
92, I had pneumonia. 94, the CMV retinitis started to accelerate. And I didn't tell anyone because I thought, through magical thinking, maybe it would go away. And then in a matter of weeks, I lost one eye. You know, this is the part I don't talk about that much anymore. I had a stroke. I was paralyzed for a year. I had pretty much everything that killed most of my friends at the time. And they died right in the room around me. I had an experience of being in something akin to a war zone. But the whole time, especially when I was paralyzed, what I did to stay sane was to pace out the farm that I had bought when I was 22. And I had bought that place and had it for a number of years before I lost my sight. So it acted like a magnet to draw me back up out of St. Vincent's, which actually it was something that I wouldn't trade, that experience. My mother always used to say, John, I would give you my eyes if I could. And I always gently told her that I didn't really want them because this experience has been so magnificent. I feel like the Cheshire Cat.
Were you still taking photographs during that time, or did you have to stop?
Well, I was paralyzed. I pretty much stopped.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I guess the most intense moment was when my family was standing around the foot of my bed and things looked fairly dire. You know, I had been told I was not going to survive much longer. And they looked, and I said, what's the matter? And they said, oh, John, we're so proud of your career. And I heard them say, were. And I thought, that was when I developed my I'll show them moment. And right. I was like, that stayed with me for the next year to learn how to walk again. And I got home. I was hobbling around using the lines on my floor of the studio to make a straight line to walk with two canes in my pajamas across the studio. I called Billy and John, who I'd kept the entire thing secret from at Wessel O'Connor Gallery. I said I would like to have a show. And they said, we'd love to have a show for you.
They didn't know that you had been sick or anything?
No, I told them everything in a nutshell, and they said, could you make the show in 6 weeks? And that was really the beginning of the outpouring of pictures that I had been collecting up in my subconscious.
Right.
They poured out like a libation out of a vase. And just, I barely even felt like I was making them. They just made themselves.
And is that when you started to be blue?
Yeah, I chose blue because when I came out of the hospital, after being nearly killed with toxic medicine that I then refused eventually to take. There was no cocktail yet. I chose the most non-toxic process. Cyanotypes are sky blue, and it's only ferrous iron salts, no silver, no acid. It's water and hydrogen peroxide and iron salts. It doesn't smell. It won't burn your hands. And when I put the show up with all the blue pictures, I thought, oh, goodness, you know, it would have been so nice if they could have been a normal color picture. And I expected a few people to come to this show. Within moments, I was surrounded by hundreds of people, people like Maurice Sendak and Martha Stewart. People checked themselves out of the hospital, which I was extremely touched by, to come down for the evening. We also sold that show out. Yeah, I didn't want anyone to leave, but when they did leave, I slid up against a wall and down to the floor, and I burst out crying.
Oh.
I had no idea that what I thought I was doing for my friends and family would turn out to be something universal.
I was asking about the blue color because I remember seeing, do you know Derek Jarman?
I do.
And you know he did that when he went blind through HIV. He made a film called Blue because that was the color that he saw.
Yes.
Did that happen for you?
Yes, I was very excited. I forgot to mention at the show, I was standing near a picture and a young woman came up to me and whispered in my ear, which people tend to want to whisper things to me of great intimacy. I really enjoyed being that person. I still do. People seem to be able to tell me anything because I can't see them. And she said, when you reach the highest state of peacefulness and the highest state of meditation in Buddhism, you see a blue pearl. She said, I believe that these are that color. They make me feel that way. Well, that's all I had here. Because being blind is not what you think. It's not all darkness. My optic nerve still works. And there's constant electrical impulse without a retina. And just my very stubborn and beloved optic nerve in my left eye shoots a beautiful ball of brightly colored orange and purple, violet light and sparkling flashes all the time.
Oh, that sounds great.
So I'm looking right at you now, and I can see where your face is. I can see that blue and purple and orange circle. It looks like Saturn. I never made obvious pictures about losing my sight. I brought a picture to show you of the first thing that I took when I came out of the studio, and I thought, oh, I better show people just what I saw when I started to get seen for retinitis. So I called my florist friends from upstate, and they sent me a bouquet of flowers. That would be, I think, image number 10.
Yeah, I've got your book right here. I'm just going to...
Spotted Floral Bouquet, it's called. And I went with my assistant to a fabric store, and I bought some chenille sort of prom material, and I draped it all over everything because it was covered with spots.
It's just beautiful. Yeah, lots of...
Well, it's very pretty, right?
It's lovely.
When I got all the pictures back, I looked at it, and I thought, that's not what I see. I said, that's what I saw mechanically, but my beauty filter in my mind is still intact. I don't need to cover up anything with chenille with dots. My vision is completely the same, irregardless of whether my eyes are working or not. So the only one that I really came to love was Spotted Floral Bouquet, so I put that in this book.
So what do you mean? You'd feel that the chenille was kind of like...
Oh, it was
a screen
much.
That was not necessary.
Yeah, it wasn't. I learned to my joy that it wasn't necessary.
Right.
That I can still be myself. You know, I was so excited, Alan, when I got home from the hospital and I was finally by myself. When I got home and I realized that I could still see without my sight, I was so excited for the first few nights. I kept both my feet on the floor trying to lean back to go to sleep. And I woke up the next morning leaning back with my feet on the floor. I was too excited to go to sleep because nothing was over. It had just changed, you know. And the climax of that is the Metropolitan Museum of Art last year bought 30 of my prints for their permanent collection. And I'll tell you what, you set a goal in life and, you know, you're in art school and you think, oh my gosh, you know, what about being in the Met? And then you're in the Met. Now I have to set another goal. You know, the reaching of any goal is usually a slight letdown. It's the journey to the goal that, and everyone knows that, but boy, I can tell you it's been true for me. So I thought, what's next? Well, what's next is to have a full-on show at the Met and invite every single person that I know.
Oh, so that's your next?
Well, that's in my dream world, you know, and then
put it out there.
Yeah.
I think it's obviously so inspiring, John, but also I was just thinking back to what you said about being in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this amazing spirit and amazing way of thinking and positive thinking and visual creation that you have is why you're alive, is how you managed to go through that horror?
I'm alive because my mother brought me elbows and macaroni with Parmesan cheese and beans every single day for a year. And I kept them in the nurse's station, and those are what kept me alive. And the spirituality that was never completely explained in my Roman Catholic Italian speaking church in Stamford, Connecticut came, you know, again, using the word distilled down to just pure, the spirit and the beauty of that belief system really helped me. It was no harm that my brother and sister and my mother joined hands over my bed and said a brief prayer every time they left.
It's combo of the macaroni and spirituality.
Yes.
Let's take another picture. This is number 3, untitled, at Lockwood Farm. This is you.
This is the second stage of me realizing... It's a lovely picture in
it's
the
beautiful.
Parlor,
mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting with my eyes closed, and I thought, I've got to show people I'm blind and I'm still working. I was hell-bent on showing people that I was still working, and collected up all these marvelous pink lusterware teacups from the 1840s.
And you're sitting at a table with like 1, 2, 3, 6, 7.
Six cups, and yeah. I thought, I better put on a blindfold. This is very similar to the chenille, and I felt so silly with the blindfold on. It seemed so obvious, so I took the blindfold off. And it sort of looks like I'm playing three-card Monty or the cup and ball game movie.
It does look like you're kind of a naked magician.
Yeah, well, I am. Most of the time, you know, we can talk about that later, why so little clothing in my pictures.
I was coming to that.
But it's neat. The table looks like it's levitating because it's too short for me to sit under. And the picture became very successful. I never could even think of a title. So in that sort of postmodern way, the title became Untitled, Self-Portrait with Teacups. And it's just me being very proud and very excited to show people that even without your sight, you can easily arrange something into a beautiful picture.
Now, a lot of the time you have put your images alongside poetry, Whitman, Emerson. Why are those writers so important to you?
Oh, my goodness, especially Emily Dickinson, who I tried to read on and off for years, but it was almost Greek to me. I could not penetrate what she was saying. But after my own transcendental experience of facing the loss of my life and then the peacefulness that came with that, the realization that you really are not your body, and then reading Emily Dickinson, she spoke to me, so I read all 1,776 of her poems on book on tape from a research library in Princeton, and then I illustrated those. I mean, Emily Dickinson flew over her house in a chariot and observed her life from above before there were airplanes, before there was anything, and I totally identified with that when I was paralyzed. It was very easy to leave my body.
So when you make a picture of... in your head, do you hear the words from the poem?
When I'm laying in bed at night, I kept a dictaphone next to me while I was paralyzed. And while I was listening to things or things were happening in the hospital, I recorded just a line or a phrase, a bit of prose or even a word. And especially when I got home, I had to constantly wake myself up. I'd fall asleep with my earphones listening to Dickinson and have to jot down a phrase, and that instantly appeared as a picture full blown in my mind.
I mean, it inspired you to think of a future image you're going to capture.
Mm-hmm. They all exist already. I just have to reach in. It's like a Rolodex in my head.
John, I'm intrigued by this photograph of yours. You took a self-portrait of yourself at 42, and it's a diptych. It got you at 52.
Mm-hmm.
You look amazing at 52. And you're how old now? 54?
54. I can't wait to be 62, although I'm also taking my time. I have so much to do.
Yeah. But what is next? You've got this amazing, incredible life, and you're such an inspiring person. And all the time I've been talking to you, there's a little bit of glitter on your nose, and it's so appropriate. You're sparkling.
I am from the West Village.
So don't take it off.
Oh, no. Okay. I wonder where that came from. Somebody here has glitter on. It must be you, Alan.
Probably.
Yeah. So what's next is I have a show in February, so I thought, how nice to just do something from home. And I had read the phrase domestic virtue somewhere in one of these, and I thought, I love being domestic and creating the stage sets in the house to be a person in a beautiful space. So the first book will be a 16x20 book of Sinotypes, one very fancy and one very affordable. And that way people who can't afford to buy a print or don't want to buy a print can go home with a book, and they'll all be the same size. And when I'm done, you know, it'll be a great reason to build a library.
John Dugdale, I'm so glad that after all these years we've had a proper chat. And
me too.
I've got over my starstruckness.
That's so good. I'm the most easy to approach person that I know.
You are. I was so in awe of you. And so if the offer still stands, would you like
Fantastic.
To take my picture?
You know, my face hurts from smiling. Thank you.
Thank you. You can see some of John Dugdale's amazing photographs at studio360.org.
Blue, here is a shell for you. Inside you'll hear a sigh, a foggy lullaby.
I'm Alan Cumming. Now, this has been a very big week for me personally because of Scotland's independence referendum. I'm Scottish, in case you hadn't noticed. And I've spent a lot of time over the past year trying to convince my fellow Scots to vote yes. As I record this, the votes are still being counted. Talking to you is actually quite a good distraction from the swirling emotions I'm feeling. But I've also said since the beginning that however the vote turns out, Scotland will never be the same. And I mean it. So if there is a God, may she bless Scotland, and may she save the Queen too. And that truly is it for this hour of Studio 360. It has been a pleasure. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Penamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
A good Scottish name to end the list, thank goodness. Special thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. The theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, New Yorker writer Hilton Alls will join us as guest host, talking with Toni Morrison.
You told your father that the work was hard and the lady was mean. And your father said,
go to work, get your money, and come on home. You don't live there, you live here. Boom. Separation.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.